Greetings, dear listeners. This is Jackson Hogan beginning a new season of Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan with one of my favorite personalities in all of skiing, Mr. Tim Cole. Now, I've known Tim Cole since the early 1980s, but unless you're an industry insider, you probably have never heard of him. When I was a member of the print era ski press, I'd always look forward to my annual meeting with Tim to discuss his ski line, RD, which was short for Research Dynamics. Mr. Cole was the consummate contrarian. I remember when the ski trade was in one of its periodic tailspins, Tim's take was that, quote, business doesn't get any easier than this. Perhaps we'll get an explanation out of him today about how he made lemonade out of commercial lemons. Cole has been out of the hard good business for decades now, at least directly, but he remains active on the equipment market as a consultant for the Midwest Ski Areas Association and has his toes in the snow as an employee of Aalto Ski Resort. He has always been a rabid fan of World Cup racing and could probably rattle off the top contenders in all disciplines. Perhaps most importantly, at least for the purposes of this podcast, he has kept his finger on the pulse of American skiing and how it fits into the worldwide context. His multiple interests make him remarkably insightful, and to top it all off, his wry sense of humor percolates through any conversation. Tim Cole, welcome to Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan.
Jackson, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Great. Thank you for being here. Over the 4+ decades that we've known each other, the ski market has gone through several radical changes. Here in America, and we have to be careful when we're talking about America as opposed to the world market today, we've seen it shrink dramatically and virtually invert its product pyramid just to stay alive. But before I turn our attention to the misty past and how we got here, let's see how well we can define the here and now. I think you would agree with me that a lot of current macro market information is not very good. Would you say that's generally true?
Yeah, with the what I would consider collapse of SIA and the internal information gathering system that we had years ago, there is less information available right now than there ever has been, and less communication between companies than there has been. So I would agree that there definitely the data set is smaller right now.
We do have one pretty good number, though, which is skier days. So those are kind of adding up turnstiles and lift tickets and, you know, wheels that actually spin to count a body, right?
Yes, and that number actually, back in the day, that number was more or less fictitious. But now with RFID and electronic pass programs, those numbers have become much more accurate. You can have a lot of confidence in where skier days are right now. And we've had a little bump here in the last few years. We've basically been 10 years in a row with the same number here.
What was it, about 52 million, something like that?
52 to 57. You know, this year was 56 or 7. And
that's the high water mark, the current high water mark.
That's the current high water mark, yes.
And as far as we know, that's historically also the highest high water mark?
Yes.
Okay. Interesting. And by the way, when you say the old records were fictitious, it's basically because there was a few numbers and then somebody extrapolated from them to come up
with something. Yes. I mean, people would take a magical number of how many times the season pass people skied. People thought back in the day that they skied more than they did on their season pass. Now what's happened is, and I would contend that there are possibly fewer skiers right now than there have been in the last 15 years or 20 years, but that they're skiing more days each. That's why skier numbers are up. It's not that there are more people skiing. It's just that people who are skiing more.
Is that driven by the season pass phenomenon, or is it a whole matrix of things which allows it to happen?
Primarily driven by the season pass program. When the Epic Pass was instituted 10, 12 years ago, that started a cascade of systems of which now nearly everyone is part of. And the consumer has been driving this. And so the consumer loves it. And they didn't want to be trapped going only to one ski area, as you would be with a country club or some other thing where you had to be a yacht club. They wanted to be able to move around and go to places. The other thing that's happened, Jackson, is that we've gone from 1,400 ski areas in the late 1970s to about 400 now. But the number of skier days have remained the same. So the people are going just as much. They're just going to fewer skiers. We've consolidated where the skiers go.
Gotcha. So we're concentrating people in such a way that we're actually overwhelming the infrastructure of those destinations.
People tend to not put in infrastructure until it's needed. And so what happens is that once the people decide that they're going to go there, then the infrastructure, so the infrastructure is only a couple of years behind the people choosing to go to these ski areas. If you look at any of the big resorts, they have, in most cases, doubled or even tripled their uphill capacity in the last 5 years.
And that's going to accelerate. You've noted to me before that right now there's more uphill capacity on order.
Yes. If you want to buy a new ski lift right now, you would probably not be able to get a delivery in 25. You would have to be ordering for 26 because they have ordered so many lifts. There's two main companies and two or three smaller ones that are building lifts right now in the United States, and they are all sold out for 2-3 years in a row.
So we have fewer skiers skiing a much higher volume. Do you expect the infrastructure problems will actually get resolved within the next 3 or 4 years?
Oh, yes. Yeah, absolutely. They're being resolved as we speak. I mean, Steamboat this year is going to double their uphill capacity. It's been true at Alta. We've gone ahead and doubled our capacity in the last 5 years.
So no new resorts, but lots of new lifts.
Lots of new lifts. And what's happened now, just in the last 2 years, is that the small, independent, single ski areas, where I deal with the Midwest quite a bit, and the 88 ski areas in the Midwest have ordered 40 new lifts, which is up from 4 5 years ago. And so all these little tiny ski areas with 1, 2, 3, 4 lifts, 5 lifts are going in now and replacing their 40-year-old riblet double chairs with 4 fixed grips or even quads. And the largest consumer of 8-packs in the United States is Boyne Resorts.
So we're seeing a multiplication of the uphill capacity at fewer and fewer venues.
The venues have pretty much stabilized now.
Sounds like they're getting upgraded now. I mean, we don't need new resorts if we actually can go out and redress all the old ones.
Well, I am always in favor of new resorts. The reality is that it's very difficult and economically practically impossible to do a new resort. The easiest way is to take an existing resort and expand it. And that's what's happening. And even the ones that were more or less marginal for 20, 30 years have now become economically sustainable. There are programs with the Indy Pass and the Powder Pass and a number of these other programs, which I wouldn't say compete with Icon and Epic. What they do is that they allow those resorts to take advantage of the same kind of demand. The skiers who've been skiing for a long time, 10, 20, 30 years, they don't want to ski at the same resort every day. They want to have that option. And now with these multiple passes, I'm on my way to Chile to look at some innovations that they're doing down there. And my Icon Pass will work down there just fine. It's changed how people look at what they own. Pay $900 for a pass. Every day after that, it's free.
So we talked a little bit now about where people are skiing and what the evolution of the skiing population looks like. Let's look a little deeper into that population. One of the current fascinations of what's left of SIA is to improve diversity in our sport, which is certainly a laudable objective. But I've often thought that that was sort of overlooking the more obvious fact that the one area in which we lack diversity is in income. If you are not reasonably flush, you are probably not skiing very much. In other words, the North American skier in particular, this is less true in Europe, I believe, but there is a crushing cost factor, which tends to drive people out of the sport shortly after their parents drive them out of the nest.
That's correct. Fortunately, we have had a rapid expansion of the 1%. So there are so many rich people out there now, and they are desperate for things to do. They have plenty of money. They have plenty of time. One of the biggest problems with people with limited income is that they don't have the time. And so as a result, and other sports have run into the same phenomenon, golf, tennis, same thing has happened. But they've been completely replaced by people with substantial incomes who have nothing better to do than go skiing. everybody keeps talking about, well, we've got to get, we got to do more programs to get more people. Ski resorts in general right now are doing everything they can to limit how many people they bring in.
And using pricing as a vehicle for that limitation.
Yeah, to a certain extent, although they'll sell you a pass for $900 and you can go 150 days, you're talking about $6 a day.
But the walk-up day pass business is still healthy.
The walk-up, it's 30 to 40% still. And at $250, you know, and next year, $300. If you take a look at golf, which is another sport for the same group of people, there are over 100 golf courses in the United States where the greens fee is over $500. And you can't get on. You try and get a tee time at Pebble Beach, and I'll tell you what, you got to be a year out. And the same thing is true at Streamstrong and all of Herb Kohler's golf course. Five golf courses in Wisconsin that are $500 a day. So when people say, well, skiing's gotten expensive, for instance, at Alta, we have five detachable chairlifts, okay, which are between $5 and $10 million each. We have tripled our salaries in the last 3 years. Tripled. And we've done that because McDonald's has done it and Walmart has done it. And so we've had to match those guys, and Vail has done it. And so in order to pay for all that, you either have to have a prepaid ski pass or be willing to pay enough to sustain that operation and all that nice equipment.
If I could quickly sort of summarize, is that the current, as far as the economics of going skiing and economics of resorts, people trying to get to them and enjoy them, the status quo is only going to evolve, but it's not going to radically change. We're going to keep Epic and Icon passes because that's what people want, and Indie passes because it's a consumer-driven side. And the areas, on the other hand, they're happy with making a ka-ching every time a pass holder shows up at their resort, a Icon pass holder or an Epic pass holder, and they're happy with the day pass result as well. In other words, from both points of view, our system, which may look broken to some, is likely to continue in whatever fashion we currently have it.
The only thing that's going to change this, Jackson, is if somehow there is a worldwide recession, depression, like the 1930s. And if that were to occur, you would have some dislocation. But until that happens, you're going to have people with the resources to go skiing and the ski areas that we're down to 450 ski areas. Okay. It's not like there's extra ski areas all around. One of the things I do with my rental program is that the country is based in 12 different departments, the sales zones for ski equipment, basically. The Midwest, Northeast, the Southeast, the Northwest, California, Colorado. Well, in every one of those sections, okay, the ski area with the highest priced lift ticket is the highest volume skier.
So the old 17th century model of how capitalism is supposed to work is not working.
Well, no, it's the reverse. So, you know, you would say, well, people would go to the ski areas that were cheap because they can go there. No, they don't want that. What they want is they want the bells and whistles, and they're willing to pay for it. And if you don't have the bells and whistles, they'll go someplace else. And number of ski areas, I think, found that out, that they didn't invest for a while and retain their profits or whatever they've spent it and didn't put in new equipment. And as a result, they got left behind by these guys that did it.
Let's switch our focus for a moment away from who is skiing and where, and switch it to what they're skiing on. What do you suppose is the size of the American market for skis? I think this is a number that has been, I don't know, I don't trust it for sure. I don't know who would promulgate one, but I'd almost challenge it on principle just because I don't think the underpinnings of how the data is being gathered is sound. Talk to me about the size of the market for skis and or boots.
They're essentially the same. The boot thing can go up and down a little bit based on some hocus pocus that the boot guys do. But in the end, I see it between 400 and 500,000 at the retail level. And then there's another between 80 and 150,000 in the rental, true rental skis.
True rental skis, meaning a fleet rental ski as opposed to something that's...
A demo.
A demo. Yeah, exactly.
The demos are included in the 500.
Okay. Is chain retail still much of a factor there, or is it mostly a special retailer in the U.S.?
There are some chains who are successful right now, but none of the historical ones, the Ski Markets, the Gart Brothers, the Sports Authorities, all gone. They're all gone. Dick's has gotten out of skiing. They're the last of those guys that's really national anymore. And so REI is still a big factor, and the internet has changed things dramatically. And who the big guys are now are completely different than what it was even 10 years ago, and certainly from 20 years ago. It's a completely different business now.
When you say the big guys, let's invert that for a moment and talk about the little guys. What do you think that the entire population of small batch producers together amount to maybe 20% of that total? I mean, there's got to be 100 small batch producers just in the U.S.
Yes, but they are all small batches. You could almost call it micro. And very few of them are doing over 1,000 units.
We've seen an enormous boom post-pandemic in backcountry. What was once a very small sort of niche, kooky, even part of the overall picture, suddenly everybody had to have backcountry skis and everybody bought them. And I would submit here that probably 80% of those purchases are once in a lifetime, will prove to be once in a lifetime.
Well, we call those garage skis. They're like garage mountain bikes, okay? Where people buy them and then they try to use them and they find out that it's tough and it's dangerous. And so the combination of being tough and dangerous narrows it down quite a bit in a hurry. What we found is that a lot of those people, the backcountry people, are really frontside skiers for the most part, and that they do both, and that the access to backcountry, Bluebird Fund just found this out, that they had a great operation. And it only attracted enough people sort of so that they weren't able to sustain it because it just didn't attract enough people fast enough. And so I think you're going to find that the backcountry thing, and we've seen the backcountry boot thing level out in our business dramatically.
Yeah, I suspect we're reaching a tipping point where we'll have more of that type of equipment in the secondary market than we will have in the primary market.
Yeah, I mean, you got to walk up.
And I mean, don't forget that, ladies and gentlemen, you have to walk up.
You have to walk up, and it, you know, and that's tough. Even at Alta, where we do a lot of walking at Alta, we find that 90-some% of the people don't do that. They just stay on the lifts and ski the regular runs because they're there to enjoy themselves. They're not there to beat themselves up.
So we've talked a little bit about how the ski gets to the consumer, but now we have, as you alluded to just a moment ago, this monster of the internet, which has totally disrupted how skis are delivered to the customer at the end of the day. What do you think that the piece of the overall business that's going direct to consumer, the business that, by the way, every brand is chasing, every brand wants to be Salomon, who I would say is the king of direct to consumer sales in the overall in the segment, because they have successfully branched away from skiing in ways that the other brands would love to, but have so far proven incapable of. So everyone wants to be B2C. How well are they succeeding? How much of their business is going that direction and how much is still going through?
You know, the companies haven't done as good a job as the retailers have. The retailers have done an excellent job.
Of being an online presence.
Yes, because it's tough. You have to have dedicated inventory. You have to have dedicated staff. You have to have people who believe in direct-to-consumer. People like Backcountry and Level 9 and Evo and these kind of guys have done a great job. Nobody buys an airline ticket by going to their travel agent. Very few people. And nobody rents a car by going to the Hertz store. No, you do it online. And Amazon has changed the way people buy popcorn. People have gotten so used to buying things online that they have no problem buying a $1,000 pair of boots online. All I can say, Jackson, is that it's a part of our life now outside of skiing. And so to have it be part of skiing is natural. And it's going to become more and more and more and more a part of it. And I have several of the retailers that I work with worth between 30 and 70% online.
How well are the manufacturers doing that are trying to be B2C, that have a big B2C presence? How successful are they at actually mining the public as opposed to the dealers themselves or as opposed to the retail community?
No, the manufacturers are not close enough to the consumer. Jordan Judd has just been replaced at Salomon. And he was the one who created that B2B thing. I mean, he's the king of the B2B, and they've just replaced him. And so I just see the manufacturers are still one full step away from the consumer. And the consumer wants to have somebody that they can talk to and they can solve their problem with and who can really do all the things that need to be done, the fitting, the exchanging, the tuning, the mounting, the whatever. Right now, I see it as a retailer-driven program much more so than, and I see Rosenthal trying to do it a little bit, and certainly Salomon, K2, they tried to do a direct deal. Nobody's right now, what I would say, owning that business. It's the next level down. When you go to Evo or you go to Backcountry, those guys are the ones who are doing it.
They're pushing the online sales.
Yeah, yes. And the consumer, that's where the consumers go to find out where they want to buy stuff.
Let's talk about another factor that industry leaders used to think of as a big threat to ski manufacturers, which is the demo market. I remember John Stoller, who, not a familiar name to most of my dear listeners, but John Stoller was a very well-respected president of
one of my real heroes.
Certainly a great defender of the specialty retail channel. He spoke about death by demo, that the ski industry is going to kill itself by this crazy business of constantly making sure that everyone gets to test the ski. What role is demo playing in the market today, and is it still a deterrent to sales?
Well, no, it's not a deterrent. People would buy fewer skis if they could not demo. Back in the day when we had $100 or $200 skis and bindings and $150 boots, yeah, maybe. But now with $1,000, $1,500, $2,000 skis, people want to make sure that what they're buying is exactly, they don't want to take somebody's word for it. They want to know what it is. And it's easy enough to get. There was a little period of where it may have made a difference while you sold demos versus retail skis. But now it's leveled out. And there's a certain number of demos in the market. All the major ski resorts have a giant demo broker.
Right.
Because the airlines charge you $50 each way and they lose them. And it's a nightmare.
That's been a genuine factor, you think, the luggage fees?
Flying in general has become a hassle. And that's just one more hassle to haul your skis in there. And it used to be that they wanted you so that you could take skis and boots and didn't charge you. Well, now skis and boots cost you an extra $100 each way. Well, not everybody thinks that's a good idea. And more and more and more of the big time ski resorts, the Vails, Aspens, that's where you go to try the good skis out. Then if you really need to own a pair, let's say you're living in Wisconsin or wherever, and you need different skis in Wisconsin than you do in Aspen, for the most part. And so why would you own skis for Wisconsin and take them to Aspen? Well, that doesn't make any sense. So you might as well just go to Aspen, and for $250 for the week, you can have the right skis. And again, a hotel room in Little Cottonwood Canyon now is $1,000 a night. It's going to cost you $50 to rent your skis. I mean, come on, it's no big deal. And I don't think it's interfered with people having their own personal skis. What it has done is it's made it much easier for people to have the right skis on the right day. When we have 18 inches of new snow at Alta, you don't need your Redster Atomic from Wilmot. Okay.
We'll go straight to the bottom.
What you need are some 105 or 110 wide powder buoys that can take you wherever you want to go. Then if we have high pressure and we're on man-made snow and it hasn't snowed in a week, and all of a sudden you're on this bulletproof machine stuff, yeah, you need a 75 wide ski or 80 wide ski. Well, you can't carry five pairs of skis from Milwaukee to Aspen. So as a result, the demo thing is an absolute necessity. And the people can afford it. It would not survive the way it is if people didn't feel like it was good value. They think it's good value. And the companies that have done it the best and have worked it out, they've figured out how to make, they had to change their pricing. Before, they had these big, big discounts. Well, now those discounts are much smaller.
Talking about pricing, one of the rationales for a higher price for anything really is that it's new and improved, and it's genuinely new and improved because we've added Xylon to it or whatever the magical material is that you've made things better with. I don't see a lot of new product innovation on the horizon. I see a lot of what I would call incremental. Some people might be a little less friendly about it, superficial bells and whistles changes, rather than the more massive investments that trying to genuinely innovate incur. I think we're looking at owners now of most brands that are more trying to milk what they've got rather than trying to say, hey, next year you'll be asked to pay $100 more, but it'll be new and improved. Next year it might be just $100 more and not new and improved.
Yeah, Jackson, you know what I think right now, and I see this in my own personal self, is that my skis now are better than I am. So to improve the skis, I mean, I don't even know what you're going to try and do. One of the things is that you can only go so fast on any of the developed ski resorts in America. Some places are faster than others, for sure. If you go to Sun Valley, you can turn it up. But if you're in Vail and you're trying to come down Bourne Tree, if you turn it up, you're going to go to jail, right? So the skis are much better now than they ever were. And as a result, they are ahead of the capability of the skier. So to improve the skis, I have no idea what you're going to do.
So innovation as a rationale for price increase is not going to necessarily stand.
No. What I have seen, classic Adam Smith supply and demand theory still works. If you can create demand and keep supply low, your price can be higher. I think you can see with Marcel Hirscher's new skis, what are they called?
No, they've won a World Cup race already, I think, on them, haven't they?
He's selling those skis for $2,500 a pair, and he sold out. The way you can do that is by keeping supply low. If you build a lot of something and you make one more than there's demand, all of a sudden the price gets trapped and goes down. So that's what's really come about from a supply and demand standpoint, is that the mass, well, it's Van Deer, exactly. Van Deer skis, V-A-N-D-E-E-R.
Right.
Yeah, and he won some World Cups with Kristoffersen. And so that's how you can keep price up. And the companies have, you know, I saw your thing where you said, well, they go $50 or $100 a year. Well, there have been some, what I would call $200 and $300 price increases here recently that have made it.
What do you mean by have made it? You mean if they stuck, the consumer didn't?
They stuck, yeah. They went to the retailer and the retailer sold them at that price. So now the premium skis, a lot of them are in the $1,400 range, $1,500 with bindings. You know, that's a long way from what they used to be at $150 or $200.
Those days are over, but there was a period of about a decade when skis sold between $599 and $699.
That's right. That's exactly right. And they stayed that way and stayed that way and stayed that way. But those days have kind of quietly, without people really recognizing it, for sure, volume is down, but I think dollars are equal or even up. So every unit that doesn't get sold is compensated for by a price increase.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about our industry, which is a word I hate applying to ski because we don't really act like other industries like steel making or shipbuilding or whatever else. But I don't have a better term, so let's just call it that for the moment. We used to have a national show that was exciting to go to. It was a 5-day show at one. Maybe it was even a 6-day show at one point.
It was 6 days at one period, yep.
And it was exciting. People showed up. It was a party atmosphere, but business got done. And along with a lot of other things we talked about this past hour, that's also gone. The institution whose one job was to hold this trade show forgot. And now it's the underpinnings which made it possible seem to have disappeared. Your thoughts on how we're going to fumble our way through the immediate future in terms of just buying and selling stuff?
Thankfully, and this has happened, I guess, by accident, but one is the abdication of SIA is going to go down as one of the unbelievable phenomena in our business. So if somebody's going to write about it, you probably will have to write about it. What happened was is that they sold the show to the Outdoor Retailer Boys for $16 million with the premise that they would continue to go to the Outdoor Retailer Show and support it. Right away, the Outdoor Retailer Show is run by the outdoor retailer people. I'm not sure if everybody understood that to begin with, but they're completely different cats than the ski people. And so that just was never going to work. And as a result, what they did was they came in and thankfully the buying group have put together this winter sports market, WSM, and have been more than congenial in how they've done it. But what they've really done is they have replaced SIA for the hard goods with their show in Salt Lake.
That show is a much more utilitarian, small booth, no fanfare, no rollerblade demonstrations or no bands.
And the ski companies, well, there were two things. One is COVID. And then what happened was, is that the cost of WSM is about 1/10 to 1/50 of what SIA costs. So as a result, everybody said, well, I think this is good enough. It turns out I've been to it the last 3 years, and in less than 4 hours or 6 hours, I've gotten more done there than I did in Denver in their 3 and 4 day show. Everybody will find a way. Plus, now the internet has changed again, everything. A lot of the buying and selling doesn't, particularly with young people, the Gen X, Gen Y, Gen Z, I don't know all the names of them. The kids, the 25 to 40 year old buyers, are so used to buying everything on the internet, and they don't have in-person meetings anymore. They don't even answer their phone. All they do is text and do some sort of internet-based buying program. And it's much more efficient. What happened to SIA was that its inefficiency ate it alive. And now for 10% of what you used to spend in Denver, you can go to Salt Lake and do the same amount of business with the same quality retailers, and it works out just fine.
Just as a coda to that, most of the time that you and I knew each other when we were both engaged in the ski trade back in the 80s and 90s, SIA had within it an ongoing war between the clothing side, which wanted to have the show earlier and earlier and earlier because their production was in the Orient, they had much longer lead times. And the hard goods people wanted to delay because they felt that they would get a better order if they could push the order opening to later in the season. Well, that battle's finally been over. And much to my surprise, soft goods won, because all that's left now is a so-called winter show in November. But I don't think there's going to be a victory parade because I don't think anyone's going. I think we finally reduced the show to the point that it's going to be attendance-free. What are your comments?
First of all, WSM is an absolute viable operation, and it's tremendous for the hard goods side.
But it's that, just, dear listeners, that's separate from SIA and any of its other institutions.
Yes, completely separate. And thank God they hired Debbie DeRoach to run it, and she's doing a great job. The whole operation is just spectacular. And then the soft goods guys, they have to be so much earlier that a show doesn't work for them. And now there's a new show in Denver that's coming up that the soft goods guys are going to try and have, and we'll see if it works. This will be the first year for it. And they're going to try and do with soft goods what WSM is doing with hard goods.
Here's a out of left field comment for you. Wither snowboarding.
Jackson, I can tell you that snowboarding has gone through what I would call a dead cat bounce, in that it was going up, 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 because it was starting from zero or near zero 20 years ago. Every year was going up, 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 up. Then it finally plateaued. And that plateauing, they saw the lack of acceleration as being going downhill. But it never really did go downhill. It just plateaued. And then it's gone on a plateau for about 3, 4, 5 years now. And now, in the last 2 years, snowboarding has made a comeback. And it's accelerating again. There are quite a few fathers who have come back into snowboarding so that their kids can snowboard. And as a result, the snowboarding thing is alive and well. It has stayed true to itself in some ways better than the skiing guys have. They don't overproduce as much as the ski side does. There aren't these giant overstock situations. The snowboard thing is healthier. And there are certain ski areas that you go to now that have attracted snowboarders, and they like to be amongst themselves. And so if they have the right vibe at the ski area. I know in Utah, we have 2 or 3 ski areas now that are snowboard centric. You know, you can go to a certain ski resorts and I mean, they'll be 70-80% snowboard.
This is your podcast in a way, as opposed to mine. And I know that you love World Cup racing. Would you care to comment about this corner of our sport? Who, for instance, are the up and coming stars behind the incomparable Shiffrin?
On the US side, there's a long space in between Shiffrin and the next level. And it's true on the men's and women's side. And we've gone through some trauma actually with the ski team and changing. You know, we have a new director, Sophie, who school's out. We'll see if she can really pull it together. She's very good at fundraising, which is that's one side of it that we need to get organized here in the US. The Europeans are exerting their strength again, and we really are not combating it. So we've just lost the two downhills up in Lake Louise. Anytime we lose a race here, it affects us a little bit. Going forward, I mean, there are some kids, River Adamus, the girl from Jackson Hole. There are some people coming up. But right now, the ski team is in what I would call a lull. But we're world champions. We own the World Cup. So on one hand, we're celebrating that we're the best in the world. And on the other hand, I mean, we're not very deep. When it became so expensive, one of the areas that suffered from that is ski racing. It is remarkably expensive now. It's between $30,000 and $50,000 a year to be a ski racer. And not everybody, not hardly anybody can afford that. We're losing all kinds of good athletes to other sports because they can play golf, they can play lacrosse, they can play other things, and they just don't feel like it's worth $30,000 to become a ski racer. And there's lots of people working on this. We'll see if anybody is successful. It's going to be a challenge for sure. And you can never underestimate how tough the Central European guys are. The Swiss and the Austrians and the Italians and the French, they really care about ski racing, much more so than the U.S. Here, it's a kind of an add-on. There's a few of us who are diehard, can't do anything else because we're not capable. So we are ski racing committed, but we are a very, very small group of people. And it's going to take some real effort to get the ski team back up to where we're there with more than just one person. There is not a male slalom skier in the top 30. It's just unfortunate. And we have to figure that out. We have to get better. Hopefully we will.
We're recording this podcast in the swelter of summer. It must be, you know, what it's like where you are, but it's, boy, you're in Hawaii right now.
I am in Hawaii and it's very nice here. Although we just had a hurricane and everybody should try and be right on the edge. You don't actually want to be in the center of the hurricane, but being on the edge of it is pretty exciting.
At any rate, last season's record snowfall at Alta, where you work, and other Western resorts, feels like it was a different planet then to now. But let's bring winter back into our discussion. What do you do on a typical winter day? What does Tim Cole do after he gets up in the morning?
I'm employed by Alta on a certain number of days a year. I show up there, and I am the third assistant ticket checker, and I work with our RFID ticket system. RFID tickets do two things. One, they allow people to get up the mountain and go skiing. And two, they allow the resort to keep non-payers off the mountain, which is a bigger issue than you might think. There are just a tremendous number of people who feel that it's in their best interest to try and scam the resort and get up the hill without paying. It's a spy versus spy type scenario. And we do everything we can to make sure everybody with a legitimate ticket gets up. And those without don't. We have quite a few seasoned guys at Alta. I'm one of the seasoned guys there. And we're constantly training new people and getting the kids up to speed is exciting and fun. And in the process every day, I get my four or five runs in. One of the benefits of being at a ski area is that you sometimes get preferential treatment for when you can ski. And that seems to be worth it for me. And you know, last year, everybody thought, well, we had the best year ever at Alta. We had 900 inches of snow. We had 20 days where the road was closed. We had another 20 days where it was open, but only after several hours. And it was a nightmare to get up there. This winter, for me personally, was not the best winter ever. Just getting to the ski area was a nightmare. We do a lot better at Alta with 500 inches than we do with 900 inches. I can tell you that.
Looking forward to a more modest winter this year?
You know, you can never pitch when it snows. But yeah, we've got an El Nino in place right now. And the last several of these big El Ninos have not been that kind. And so we dropped below the 500, even down to like 350 or 375. And 375 at Alta is not enough. That, again, is an issue. We would like to be right around 500 inches starting in the middle of November and skiing our brains out all winter and get my 120 days in or 130 days. I'm 76 years old, so 100 days a year is a lot for me now. I still get my 100 days a year pretty regular.
100 days a year, that is a phenomenal number. And on that high point, I want to thank you for spending so much time with me today, sharing your incredible history and wisdom and insight into this crazy sport. I'm so impressed that you remain engaged, not just with the sport, but with the sport on so many different levels. Wish I had more time to share with my readers all of it, but I don't want people to tune out. So better to tighten it up. Did you have one day, one moment, one instant that was just totally redemptive, made the whole thing worthwhile?
Well, yes. I mean, as always, you get that scenario where you're at the top of the mountain alone with 18 inches of new snow, and you and one or two or three or four others are fully equipped and ready to go. And, you know, this year with the road closed, we had several scenarios where you could get up to Alta and then the road closed and we didn't let anybody else in. We call it country club. We had several country club days this year where we got to ski almost like on a helicopter. It couldn't have been any better. I had several of those days this year.
I hope to meet you on a country club day this coming winter, Tim. Thanks again.
Well, yeah, Jackson, this is great. Anytime. Hopefully we survive a few more years. We can do it again.
I look forward to it. Thanks, Tim. And thank you, dear listeners, for spending some of your precious time with us on Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan. Thanks for listening.